This week on It's So Bad, would you kindly join us for our discussion of BioShock?
To the podcast. Matt, thank you so much for that introduction.
Thank you.
Steve as well, thank you for joining us. And Chris.
Michael, hello.
Hello.
Hello all.
How are you? So, this week on the podcast we're discussing the game BioShock. What does everybody think about that?
I'm pretty excited about it, you know? This is a game I played a long time ago. I actually never finished it, so it was cool to go in with fresh eyes and finally finish the job.
Has anybody played this game before we start talking about this?
I have. I beat the entire series on 360 way back in the day. I pretty much got them all upon release as they came out.
Very cool. This was during the period, like I've talked about this before, the PS3, like 360 era, I was kind of out on like mainstream games. I was playing more stuff that was like, I wouldn't necessarily say it was indie, but more like focused on retro stuff at that point because of the Wii Virtual Console and stuff like that. So this game kind of was out of my radar at the time. I remember ads for it, but Chris, did you play it?
I played it a little. I never owned it, but I did play it a little bit back in the day with I had other friends that owned it, but my experience with it was pretty minimal. So this was really my first substantial dive into the BioShock franchise.
Cool.
Yeah, I remember playing this my freshman year of college, and it was like early on in like the fall or something. So I was like in my freshman dorm room, and I didn't have a real TV, so I had like my 360 plugged into a small computer monitor, and I was like sitting at my desk playing it that way, which was weird experience for a console gamer at the time. But I never finished it, so I went back and played it now this time. I had played BioShock Infinite before though, so that one I had finished. That was my experience in the BioShock world.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I didn't play these types of games until we were talking about it. I played Dishonored a few years ago, and I really got into the, I guess you would call them more immersive sims is what people call them. These games where you're like finding notes and have all these different powers. That's just generally what I would say the genre is called. But yes.
Yeah, I never realized that was what the immersive sim genre was. I'd always heard that. But for me, these always just struck me as like first-person shooters that weren't like Call of Duty.
Yeah, that's how I always kind of thought of it too. Is I didn't think of it as an immersive. I guess that's just not what I expected an immersive sim to be.
Right. It's like very story narrative driven first-person shooter games. Typically, they're associated with like a variety of different powers that you obtain, and also with you finding like fragments of story around in the environment. And also, the environment is used to tell the story, so that's what generally an immersive sim is. So, like, Dishonored is more like a stealthy game, but it also could be considered an immersive sim. But like games like Prey and Deus Ex and System Shock are your immersive sim genre. But yeah, I didn't mention this, but you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify. You can follow us on Twitter at It's So Bad Pod. But yeah, we're adding this game this week to our endless list, which is our list of games, the best games, the worst games, all the games in between. Goes up right now from number one, Super Mario 64, all the way down to number 81, Jurassic Park Trespasser. Last week, we added Gunsmoke to our endless list at number 67. And just generally every week, we add a new game. Could be anything, mediocre or otherwise. But yeah, our list is, what are our rankings judged by? How good the games are, in our opinion, if they hold up, their impact on the overall video game canon, everything we try to consider in our ridiculous ranking of every list ever. But yeah, this week
let's not forget the all-important completeness of vision.
Completeness. we haven't talked about that in quite some time, but completeness of vision is high on the list of what is considered. But yeah, so this game, developed by 2K Boston and 2K Australia, published by 2K Games, was released in 2007 for the PC, PS3, and Xbox 360. Has been re-released in the collection, the BioShock collection, for PS4 and Xbox One. And recently, as of like 2 weeks ago, it's now on the Switch, which would be an interesting experience to play this game on the Switch, because I feel like there's a lot of details you're probably missing if you play this game in portable mode.
You have to squint at a lot of things.
There's a lot of environmental storytelling in this game, so you can miss stuff in the background that you would probably normally see on a bigger screen.
There's also a infamously bad iOS port for BioShock several years ago.
Really?
Yeah, it didn't last too long because of how like it was. It came out. I remember it was like just like a couple bucks, and but it was actually taken down because I think it was like extremely buggy, and they just like didn't put any effort into like trying to patch it or fix it. They just said, nope, this was a bad idea. So BioShock came and went.
I never knew that that happened. Interesting. Yeah, so this game was developed initially as a spiritual successor to System Shock 2. The people who made it, 2K Boston, previously worked on System Shock 2, in particular the creative director, Ken Levine, who he worked on System Shock 2. It didn't sell very well, System Shock 2, but it was critically lauded, so they wanted to make a spiritual successor, but also wanted to get funding from a bigger company, so they needed to prove to whoever was going to give them funding that this game would actually sell. So they tried to basically popularize this genre that they had created previously with the System Shock games. Anybody here ever play System Shock or System Shock 2?
No, I have never played them.
No, it's a game that after I played this game, I definitely want to play it. I didn't realize that BioShock and System Shock were in the same lineage until after researching for this game, which is kind
of... Would you say you were shocked to learn that?
Yes, a little bit.
I mean, you watch. I watched some gameplay footage of System Shock, and it like really does look like just like a really like older, low quality version of BioShock. Like it looks like the assets like were just really kind of like upgraded and reskinned. It like really like you can just tell watching a video. I was like, oh, that must look and play, play and handle just like BioShock does. Like it looks like they just really just put it like a fresh coat of paint on that.
Yeah, so System Shock 2 came out, I think, in 1999. So this game had been in the works for quite a while, but they did some other stuff that wasn't like anywhere near this type of like depth of a game before this. The developer, but this one was kind of what they were aiming for as their like aspirational goal was to make a spiritual successor to System Shock 2. And they got there. I mean, and if you look up in the lead up to this game, you had games like Deus Ex come out. In the same year, you had Stalker, Shadows of Chernobyl. So these games were starting to come out. I mean, like Half-Life 2 is like quasi like this game, although because you're like interacting with the world, but it's not.
I was just gonna say that. I'm looking at some pictures of System Shock 2, and the first game that came to mind was Half-Life. I was like, this kind of looks like Black Mesa.
Right. Except that I would say that so. Half-Life exists as more of a first-person shooter because there's no, aside from like in Half-Life 2 at least, the gun where you can pick up objects, there's no like real different verbs for you to interact with the world except for shooting stuff, right?
There are the antlions, so you get like these balls and you can throw them, and then like a bunch of like giant creatures come, and there's a level where you can throw them and it's like a pheromone ball or something, and all these creatures will go attack people. But I think that's like the only other kind of non-gun weapon.
I don't remember that at all.
Yeah, that's a sweet level. You're like you're assaulting some sort of like prison or base or something, and you're on this beach, and you get this pheromone like ball or something like that, and you can use it to direct the antlions at the combine.
Interesting. Yeah, we have to play that game at some point. Especially
it's a great game.
The first one I've never played, so I need to go back and play that one.
Yeah, same. I've never played the original. I've seen parts of it. I've had my eye on Black Mesa though, the like fan remake.
Right. I've heard that's different though, but nevertheless, so this game too, it was supposed to be So we mentioned that it was supposed to be a spiritual successor to System Shock 2. It also was supposed to initially be a spaceship, but they went with the underwater setting to kind of set it apart from System Shock. But it's basically, practically, it's the same thing, right? So a underwater layer is practically the same thing as a spaceship when you're walking around in it, right?
Yeah,
The space and the bottom of the ocean, they're pretty similar.
No, I mean, like from the interior design standpoint, you could have done everything that they do in BioShock on a spaceship, as opposed to it being underwater.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Well, I actually wasn't entirely kidding about that, though, too. Like, space and the bottom of the ocean, I feel like. What's that, like, phrase? They're like, we know more about space than we know what's at the bottom of the sea or something
right.
like that. Like,
right.
And, like, they do training in the ocean, too. So I see some parallels there.
And a lot of things that they did with the surrounding dovetailed nicely into the underwater setting. And when I say that, what I mean is when you're going through, like, the tunnels and you can see out, they wanted you to see, like, a detailed landscape, but not too detailed because it, like, because of the way the water works, you can't see too far. It, like, obscures distance in a way that they needed to obscure distance because of the power of the platform at the time. So they couldn't, like, make, like, these big sprawling vistas because they were working with, like, a PS5 or, like, a modern PC. They were working with the PS3 and Xbox 360 at the time.
Yeah, usually you see, like, a neon sign and, like, a couple of buildings, underwater buildings, and, like, maybe something floating by, like a whale or something like that. That's about it.
Yeah.
Somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me, my lover stands on golden sand and watches the ships that go sailing somewhere beyond the sea.
And I don't know if you guys know this, but Ken Levine, who is the creative director, do you know what he was reading when he started to come up with his ideas for the story?
I don't know.
I have some guesses.
Sports Illustrated?
Could it be some Ayn Rand?
I was going to say a Communist Manifesto, but I don't really make sense.
Yeah, he was reading The Fountainhead when this game was being, when he was making the story for this, and he said that this is the direct inspiration, obviously, for this. Even though, this game is basically way more in the John Galt Atlas Shrugged vein of, making a society that's separate from current society, a utopia, if you will.
Well, aren't there literally posters hanging on the wall that says, like, who is Atlas? Like, similar to, like, who is John Galt? Yeah.
Yeah, but Andrew Ryan is more the John Galt in this scenario, isn't he? I don't know anything about Atlas. I know just the baseline. And I think the parallel John Galt is Andrew Ryan in this scenario.
Yeah.
Yeah, should we get into the story and background a little bit for this, too? Because it's, like, all about that, like, American industrial myth-making, like, you know, strong businessman who shapes the future of American society.
Yeah, so the game starts off, plane crash, you get out. And I didn't know anything about, really, the story, aside from the fact that I knew, going into this without having played it, I knew a couple things. I knew that it was set underwater in a place called Rapture. I knew there were these things called Big Daddies. And I knew that that was basically... And also that this was basically like, a failed utopia, capitalist utopia. That's what I understood it to be, right?
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, you start off and a plane crashes, and I was, like, taken aback that that's how you started off this game. I was like, really? This guy crashes in a plane and just so happens to land in this one specific location where this thing is? Are you kidding me?
But there, of course, is more to that than it's...
Right.
Right. Yes.
I love that opening, by the way. That is, like, a very...
On.
Right.
Yeah. That's a very striking opening when you land, and there's just, like, the flaming wreckage around you, and then there's the lighthouse and the moon behind it.
Right. And so you go down, and I think the great thing about how this game introduces itself is that you don't meet an enemy until you're, like, a little bit deeper into it, but it's all, like, very... You have to be cautious about what you're doing, and you can, like, look around a little bit and see some bits of the story just kind of populate as you walk through this initial environment. So you're seeing, like, a statue or a head of Andrew Ryan with his logo right when you enter into the lair of the lighthouse, or with his, like, slogan right on the the piece. And then there's like different plaques that say industry and like knowledge and all this other stuff. And so they're giving you an idea of what you're about to experience. And I thought that was a really good way to set up the story a little bit.
Yeah, that first view of Rapture is like when you're kind of getting like a view of the landscape. And I think I said this like offline, it's like it's very much like the old silent film Metropolis, and kind of like how like Tim Burton like did like Gotham City and stuff like that. Very like cool opening reveal of Rapture.
Yeah,
it's like that Art Deco style architecture, like 1950 in this game, or 1960?
It's 1960. I think this was all built in the 40s, though.
Right, yeah, so it has that kind of like older aesthetic.
Yeah, so, and it was Ken Levine, who's the creative director, he has said that he was walking through Rockefeller Center, and that's where he pulled all the Art Deco from. But yeah, the plaque when you first walk in is, it says, "In what country is there a place for people like me, Andrew Ryan?" So you get like this sense of like, oh, we're going to this different place. And then you enter the bathysphere, which is the thing that takes you down lower. And they show you like a video of what Rapture is. And that video is obscuring the load screen of where you're seeing when they lift up the screen, then you see Rapture, and it takes you through to where to your destination, which is Kashmir, the restaurant, in the first segment. So... yeah, I mean, so the idea behind Rapture is that basically Randianism to the extreme, right? So it's a objectivist paradise. The moral purpose of one's life is the pursuit of one's happiness, is what...
It's capitalism, the city.
Yeah, laissez-faire capitalism. Social systems should be focused on a respect for individual rights, is what Ayn Rand subscribed to, and Andrew Ryan. And I don't think Rand's ever specifically mentioned in this game.
But I don't think so. I figured that like she probably does not exist in this universe. I figure this is probably, even though it is like an alternate Earth, I would imagine that Andrew Ryan is the world's Ayn Rand in this game.
Also, I don't know if you guys know this, but Andrew Ryan sounds an awful lot like a certain author that we're talking about. The name.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's a little on the nose. Yes. Little on the nose. Yeah.
Look at that. So, and he's definitely got those like Rockefeller or Carnegie, like American industrialist elements, like just baked in right there. Even like Walt Disney, definitely. I remember reading a little bit about that. Like it's kind of like this like capitalist theme park that you're going through.
Yeah, and I think the biggest tension in this game, right, is that you are dropped into this capitalist theme park, right? But you have no choice, right? There's no choices for you to make. The only choices for you to make are do you save the children or do you harvest them? But everything else within the story context is just there. You're not an individual. You're just on this ride that somebody's taking.
The only choice is when you encounter like the little sisters who are like these creepy little girls who have the like serum. What is it called? The plasma.
Adam.
Yep. That's what it is. Yeah. And so like you have to harvest that from them, and you can either spare them or you can kill them and harvest more of it. And that's how you get your crazy superpowers, like throwing lightning bolts at people and shooting bees out of your hands.
Yeah. And we didn't really explain this, and it's not really explained that well, but when you first enter Rapture, you encounter this like this vending machine that has a needle in it, and you just take it and you stick it in your arm. There's no explanation narrative-wise why you're doing that.
I thought that Atlas tells you to do it because when you crash, you get on the radio with this guy who's like got this Irish accent, and he's like, "Oh, like I need you here. Like they've got my family," and I think he tells you to inject yourself with it because you don't have any weapons or something like that.
Oh, okay.
You didn't really commit to that Irish accent too long there.
No, we didn't. Well, we'll get to that.
That Irish accent, by the way, was chosen specifically because they thought it was the most soothing of the accents. They did they did focused testing on the accent and which one people would like succumb to more easily.
People love an Irish accent.
Yeah, well, you know, maybe 2K Boston should have stepped outside of their world a little bit when it came to came to that, but.
Boston has agreed that the Irish accent is ideal.
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting when you first like step off the bathysphere, the thing that the submersible that takes you from the surface to the Rapture area. You start to get bits and pieces of the story even without Atlas telling you stuff, but just looking around. So when you enter into the restaurant Kashmir, you actually see Atlas with the globe on his shoulders is like the big statue when you first walk in.
Good thing he doesn't shrug.
Yeah, and you start to see different like ads everywhere for different things, and it starts to commit to show you more of what this world is that you're being taken into, which is this place where Andrew Ryan set it up. He's, as we said, he's like a Carnegie type figure who sets up this undersea utopia in quotes where anybody can do whatever they want with no regard for, you know, everybody else, really. It's just capitalism to the extreme. You go off and you do you. Until
no big government to get in the way.
Right, no big government to get in the way. So one of the things that they do in this utopia is that they have way more advanced science because there's no regulations around the work that they do. So they make big strides in different sorts of things like plasmids, which allow you to have supernatural powers, basically. Like the first thing you get is the electroshock, where you can shock people with your fingertips, Palpatine style.
Yep.
And then you get like telekinesis, and you get fire. You can light people on fire. And I don't know how a society would function if everybody had these superpowers.
Insect Swarm was one of my favorites.
Oh yeah, I didn't use that much. Did you guys use Insect Swarm a lot?
I forgot about it this time until like the end of the game, and then I was like, oh right, I can shoot bees at people. I just like unloaded bees from that point out.
I was pretty disproportionately using the lightning and the force push, or sorry, telekinesis, whatever, you know.
Yeah, you basically become a Jedi in this game. So.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy that everyone could do this at one point in the society. Like, I can't believe that this city crumbled because everybody has superpowers. what a surprise.
That you can get from a vending machine.
So the main antagonist in this, Andrew Ryan, has like an army of these things called splicers, which I guess are just people who use too many plasmids. And he can.
Yeah, I thought of them as like tweakers, basically.
Right.
Like every time they said splicer, I heard tweaker.
And they like can come and attack you, and some of them have powers, like they have lightning powers, and some of them have guns and whatever. But they all look like just zombie freaks. They don't. They're pretty non-descript, I would say.
Yes, there's some of them that have like hooks for hands and stuff too, and like run around on the ceilings. Like they're pretty crazy.
Yeah, did you guys ever take pictures of them to research them to make them easier to kill?
Yes. I did, because there was that mission that forces you to do it.
But did you do it after that?
I did a little bit after that, but then I think, yeah.
I feel like after I played through that game, I was like, I probably should have done that more, because there were certain enemies that I could take down really easily, and there's certain enemies that I just could not take down very easily.
Yeah,
because
you get like a damage boost on them if you take a bunch of pictures.
Yeah, and it tells you like what ammo is more effective against some enemies when you take more pictures of. Yeah.
I didn't know.
You learn a lot through the pictures.
Yeah, and so beyond the powers, we didn't mention that you also have like guns, and there's a machine gun, there's a pistol, there's a grenade launcher, there's a flamethrower. I'm trying to think of what else there is.
Shotgun. Yeah. Crossbow.
The crossbow is a really good one.
You get your wrench. Your handy wrench.
Yeah, you get
wrench. You start off with the wrench.
And so you have these ways you can interact. And essentially, they set it up so that there's basically like levels. So you start off in like the restaurant level, and then you go to the doctor's office. I think there's like 8 or 9 different areas for you to explore. You can go back to those places. But aside from killing more big daddies, I don't think you really need to go back anytime.
Right. No. And so the big daddies you encounter throughout the map, and like we talked about those little sisters. So the big daddies are like the big scuba gear, like, you know, diving suit equipped guys with what are those? Like a drill for an arm.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
They protect the little sisters, but they don't automatically come after you either. Like you have to choose to pick a fight with them.
Right.
And otherwise they'll just walk right by you.
So, it's not a fight with them. The way it's set up is if they perceive you as a threat to the little sister, then they'll fight you. I mean, if you shoot them, then obviously they're going to feel like they're a threat to the little sister. But yeah, they'll just walk around normally. They'll fight the other splicers.
Right.
All
yeah, you
the
can
time.
Get like you can get abilities to like hypnotize them and like get them on your side and go after the splicers, which they will mess people up.
Yeah. And just normally when they're walking around an environment, they'll sometimes pick fights with various different splicers just chilling. So one of the one of the aspects we didn't talk about in the story is that there's these little girls who like look like mutated freaks who are like supposed to be, I think, like 5 or 6 years old or something like that. And they are used to grow Adam somehow. And that I don't really understand how that works.
I think the Adam, they say, comes from like sea slugs that they discovered on the ocean, under the ocean. And so somehow they like injected the sea slug DNA into these girls and like turned them into like harvesting human Adam machines or something. I don't know.
Yeah. They never really explained how that works, but I will say it to you that initially they wanted it just to be sea slugs. So, initial concepts for this game, had when you killed a big daddy, a slug would be following it and you would take the slug and get the Adam out of it. And then they changed it to little sisters because they thought that would be more like evocative and emotional for you.
That was kind of like the controversial thing when this game came out, because it was like, oh, you can like kill little girls in this game? Like, that's pretty crazy.
Also, that choice was not something that the 2K team decided on. The 2K team had like two mandates brought down from higher up in 2K. So 2K Boston didn't want you to have a choice, and they also didn't want there to be two endings. They were mandated by the 2K headquarters to do this.
Interesting. That's weird.
Yeah.
Huh. So did they say why they didn't want to do that?
They said that they would sell more if they did that.
So was the default that you would save them or that you would kill them? Like when you didn't have a choice.
Just to jump ahead, not to talk specifically, but Ken Levine in the commentary for this game said that the good ending is the canon ending and the bad ending is something they just threw together. So make of that what you will, but I think that you were always supposed to save the little sisters in this game. Did you guys all save them or did you harvest them?
I saved them. So you like harvest, but you don't harvest all of the atoms, right? So they don't die.
I saved them because I'm a good man.
I saved them in this playthrough, like, but this game then I was thinking about,
like,
my 360.
I remember this came out around...
Oh, sorry, what was that, Matt?
What? Yeah.
So in my recent playthrough, I did save all the little sisters, but when I played for 360, I did harvest all of them. I noticed it was much more fun to do that because all my plasmids were maxed out. So playing through the game, you know, you were kind of like, you had every superpower, you know, on three or whatever it was. So that was better. But, you know, I remember the creepy ending that I don't want to spoil right now, but yeah.
I will say also too that it's supposed to be, I think they say that you get more Adam if you harvest them as opposed to rescuing them, but they give you gifts if you rescue them, and the gifts at the end of the day, at the end of the game, amount to the same amount of Adam that you would have got if you just went the good guy route.
Right. Yeah, I figured that was the case because every once in a while, they like whoever the like woman who invented these kids gets on the radio and is like, "There's a little sister coming with a gift for you."
Tannenbaum, Bridget Tannenbaum. She's the German, I think, doctor who is talking to you over, and you actually see her a couple times. She is right. The one who worked with Fontaine to discover a way to mass produce this Adam with the little sisters. So when I first started playing this game, I thought she was like a Nazi. I got serious Nazi vibes from her talking, but I think she's from Eastern Europe. And she wasn't necessarily a German, but she definitely comes across like a mad scientist Nazi when you first start talking to her. So I harvested the first little sister. And then the second one, I saw her and I was like, no, I'm going to rescue her. So I tried to be the good guy. So, but yeah, I guess when I was listening to the commentary track for this and they were saying like, there's no real reason for you to ever suspect that rescuing them is a bad idea. It's always put up front that it's supposed to be the good thing for you to do. But then I was like, I was thinking to myself, I'm like, this woman definitely had Nazi vibes when I first encountered her.
Yeah, so the German scientist in like post-war, you know, America is like a common trope.
Right.
But they do, like, the Atlas does tell you when you encounter her. He's like, oh, don't trust her. Like, those little girls are just like animals, basically. Like, you just got to harvest them. Like, don't listen to her. You're making a mistake. And she's like, no, don't do that. And, like, you don't really know who to trust. But at this point, the guy with the nice Irish accent has been your friend.
But doesn't she say, like, if you save them, she'll like give you like some reward or something, but she doesn't like really ultimately give you a reward, right? Like I know like it kind of impacts.
She gives you.
Does she?
Yeah, she. So there's like teddy bears that show up at the vending machines that help you.
Oh, okay. That I see. That's like the significance of that. I didn't finish the game, so I didn't necessarily put that together.
Yeah, so those teddy bears give you powers, so you don't have to purchase them. So they'll like unlock specific things for you as you go, depending upon what which little sisters you save. And so in order to save the little sister, you have to take down a big daddy. And those encounters are, I thought, were one of the more interesting parts of the gameplay, where some of them are tough to take down, especially with the limitations of your ammo and the powers that you have. You have to like really figure out a way to approach it and strategize around how you're going to take this thing down, because it has like a ton of health. It moves incredibly fast. Sometimes it can stun you. Yeah, they get mad and they get angry and they beat the shit out of you.
Yeah, they bull rush.
There's slight differences. Yeah, there's slight differences when you face them. Like some of them have like guns and some of them are like more prone to charge at you, right?
Right.
I think there's like two or three different types of them.
I think there's three different types of big daddies, yeah, throughout the game.
I feel like the steel tip on the crossbow was the most effective weapon against them. Like that would take a significant amount of health, so I'd shock them and then hit them with that, and then maybe a couple of frag grenades and then whatnot. I mean, that would usually do the trick.
Yeah, I tended to do that too. Like I'd find like a obstacle I could walk it around and just shoot the crossbow at it, and then walk around and reload and go around in a circle a lot of times. Sometimes though, once you really get into the game and you start getting powers and you get things like the trap bolt for the crossbow, I'd set up traps for it and take it and like shoot it with something and then let it walk into like five different traps before it got to me.
Yeah, that's definitely a good way to do it.
Yeah, I would try to use the environment too. Like if there were security systems, you can like have an ability to turn the security systems against people if you throw them at them.
Yeah.
So I would try to do that. Or I would try to like get them to interfere with some splicers first and then like to take some health down and then I would fight it.
There was one area, I think there's a casino in one of the levels. I forget which level. But there's two machine gun. There's like robot machine guns and grenade launchers that are just like scattered about this area that you could hack. And I didn't realize before playing this the game that I'd play so much of Pipe Dreams, the NES game. That's basically what this mini game is, where you have to like configure pipes in such a way to make the flow go one way, and that's how you hack these things. But you can hack these like machine gun turrets and these grenade launchers and get them on your side. So like whenever I saw those things and I saw a big daddy near them, I'd try to hack them and then lure the big daddy into that area, and that way like the machine guns would just tank the big daddy and I would hang out and just shoot grenades at it or like a shotgun, whatever I had at the time. But yeah, the one thing that I really like about immersive games just in general is the good ones give you like a plethora of different weapons, and the environment is set up in such a way where you can interact with it and use it against the enemies that you're fighting. And it's like just an open sandbox where you have all these tools and it's really up to you to be creative and figure out the way to overcome these obstacles. And that's
yeah, a lot of the levels in this game are like you go into an area and you're looking for someone or something, and then like, and this I kind of like went back and forth about whether I liked, because I felt like it got a little tedious over time. But like a lot of times you'd be like, okay, you're in this big area, there's like seven different rooms you can go into that are all kind of spread out, and you have to find like five of like a pipe and 10 of some other item and 10 of another item or whatever it is, maybe not 10, but and then you have to like return it to the person. So you just basically have to spend like a half hour exploring all these different rooms and collecting things as you fight people, and then it advances the story.
Yeah, and I thought that one of the strongest things about this game is that I think some people would say this is a negative, but there's a lot of rooms that are optional. So you enter a space and they guide you to go in one direction, but there'll be like a whole another room that's off to the side, and at first when I was playing this, I'm like, well, I'm obviously going to come back to this room because this room's here. It exists. But that's not how the game is structured. It's structured in, like, you have to walk down this hallway, and there's, like, a bunch of rooms off this hallway, and they're entirely optional, but where your objective is, like, way down at the end of the hallway. And the reason why they set up these rooms along the side is for environmental storytelling purposes, and also for you to resource gather, because there's always, like, money or equipment, ammo, because ammo is quite scarce in this game. You're always, like, trying to find ways in which to boost your ammo. So, like, for the first half of this game, I was always low on ammo because I kept skipping over those optional areas because I thought I'd just come back to them. But I think that's a strength in that you don't have to go to those areas, but if you do go to those areas, you're rewarded not only in just, like, things that are going to help you with the gameplay, but also, like, it's going to provide you a lot more background on the story because everything in this game has a purpose. And that's one of the reasons, one of the things that the developers wanted to have. If there's a dead body on the ground, there's, you know why that body is there or how it got there a little bit. Because they'll like have like blood spattered against the wall and a gun next to the person and he killed himself. Or there's like a room filled with splicers and there's like all bodies around because the splicers all killed them. So they like show you a little bit of the history. And then there's always stuff like just descriptions on the wall or like spray paint on the wall that shows you more about what went down here and how it got to where it was. And if failing that, then they have the tape recordings of various different people, which you can listen to. And those are everywhere. I've never experienced a game where there's so much background and storytelling in audio tapes, like to the point where it's like almost overwhelming.
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like at like times I would walk around and I'd be like, this is really cool. There's so many places to go. There's so much backstory. But then like as the game went on, sometimes I was like, I get it. Like more crazy stuff happened in this room and more crazy stuff happened in this room. Like I would like a little bit more like guardrails to push me forward. Because I would have the experience where I'd be like looking for however many things I had to do to build the thing to advance the plot. And I would have gone to like 7 of the 10 rooms in the area, but the map is so difficult to read sometimes. I'd be like, how do I get to the place where I need to go now?
Right. Yeah, that map was incredibly difficult to read. And I think it's a problem. Because I was watching, I forget which site, but some site was talking about the map in that new Star Wars game, I think that you played, Steve.
Jedi Fallen Order.
Yeah, and how that map wasn't like very good, and people were like, how do people not get maps right in 3D spaces yet?
A bad map is a strong mark against a game.
Yeah, so there's like, I think just like maps in 3D games are just super hard to do in general, and I still don't think people have found a way to really do them really effectively. And this game in particular, why it's bad is because they put a flat layout of all the spaces on the map, and then they have arrows pointing to staircases that are like cross over the map and get super confusing as to where you have to go.
Right, there's not like a structured, like, this is the third floor, this is the second floor, this is the first floor. It'll be like maps everywhere, and you're like, these rooms are next to each other, or are they not next to each other? I don't understand. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a fault of this game, definitely, but yeah, I thought overall, I think this is a great game. I think, I think we can get into a little bit of spoilers here. So if anybody out there who's listening to this hasn't played the game yet, and you don't want to be spoiled, there's a moment in this game that's pretty good, and I would say, personally for me, it was better that it wasn't spoiled. And typically, I don't really care about spoilers, but I think this moment is pretty cool. So if you care about spoilers, jump ahead for like another 5-10 minutes, and we should be good. But yeah, so you just go down this descent, you're entering, you're doing the bidding of this guy named Atlas, who's this Irish guy, and his like family gets blown up in a submersible, supposedly. And you're doing all these things for him, and then you finally meet Andrew Ryan, and he tells you your actual backstory. Well, a little bit about your backstory. And he, I guess the big thing is that the "would you kindly" is a, every time the Atlas talks to you, he says "would you kindly," and that's like a trigger for you to obey him. And
I you've love been that mind, twist. Oh, man.
You've been brainwashed by Atlas, who is actually a gentleman by the name of Frank Fontaine, who is like Andrew Ryan's antagonist, to go and murder Andrew Ryan and kind of finish this war that Frank Fontaine and Andrew Ryan have been waging against one another.
Yeah, Fontaine's kind of like a gangster in Rapture. That was the read I got on him. And you are like a clone or like a genetically modified version of somebody's son? Is it Andrew Ryan or Fontaine?
You're Andrew Ryan's son, and he has I forget the lady's name. They meant just like Jolene something or other.
Jasmine Jolene.
Yeah. So you're the embryo, and Fontaine somehow acquires you, and then from there, you've basically come back 4 years later. This is what I was reading today online because I was trying to get more of the backstory.
Yeah, so the backstory is that Rapture was set up. There was a civil war, essentially, that happened at Rapture that was between Andrew Ryan's faction and Frank Fontaine's faction. Frank Fontaine is a gangster, you're right. He was a gangster in the real world, too. He came down to Rapture to kind of be, you know, uphold his individual rights and be the big man on campus. But he's also wanted to be a gangster down there, so Frank Fontaine and Tannenbaum, the scientist who created the Little Sisters, created a way to harvest Adam from the Little Sisters. So Frank Fontaine was part of that. He used that harvesting to sell via a black market to the outside world. And that's why Frank Fontaine and Andrew Ryan started to get into it and started to really to fight one another. And so they had their fight, and they had like a war between their various factions. And Frank Fontaine was supposedly killed at one point. And then this figure Atlas comes rising up out of Frank Fontaine's ashes. And Atlas was like this figure for the everyman that the underclass of Rapture kind of ascribed to. And it became like a rallying call to take down Andrew Ryan was Atlas. And so they fight each other. It ends up in like a stalemate. But Frank Fontaine and Tannenbaum have this ace in the hole, is what they call it, in the game. And the ace in the hole is Andrew Ryan's son. And that's... So Andrew Ryan and Jasmine Jolene had an illegitimate child because Jasmine works at the strip club that's in Fort Frolic. And as you go into Fort Frolic, there's always these flashback sequences that happen in the game. And she's murdered in the back room, and it's kind of weird that you see this stripper that's murdered in the back of a strip club, but she was murdered because Andrew Ryan found out that she gave her embryo to Frank Fontaine, and Frank Fontaine got her embryo because she wanted to not have to rely on Andrew Ryan's kindness and his goodwill, because that's the whole thing with objectivism, right? Is that you're not supposed to be altruistic. You're supposed to be selfish. So she wanted to also have those same ideals. So she sold her embryo to Frank Fontaine. He takes it with Tannenbaum, and they create a human being out of the embryo. That's who you are. And they use this like gene, growth thing, therapy to make you grow really fast. And in one of the tapes, they even say that at a year old, you were 50 pounds, which is ridiculous for a 1 year old. But yeah, they also imprint memories on you, and they send you off to like Kansas or something. And then somehow you're awakened via a "would you kindly" text, and you're sent on this trip on a plane, and you actually hijack the plane. That's what happens in the beginning. It's not...
Right, you crash it. It's not... It didn't just happen to crash.
Right. So you crash the plane, and then you're brainwashed by Atlas. And then the last act of the game is you getting your own sovereignty back, your own... you're making decisions, supposedly, for yourself at that point.
Right, and then at that point, too, like, that's where the choice between the Little Sisters comes in, too, because at the end, like... Tannenbaum and the Little Sisters like will be helping you along too, and if you have saved more Little Sisters, like they'll kind of be like your allies and help you in the final fight against Fontaine.
Yeah, but they do that anyways. They'll do that anyways.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Either way, nothing changes in the game. The only thing
I assumed they wouldn't be there if you had killed a bunch of them.
So they're not. So yeah. So there's less of the Little Sisters in the orphanage when you get rescued after Andrew Ryan forces you to kill him. Which is fucked up.
Oh, right.
That whole scene is fucked up.
Forgot about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then you figure out that you're brainwashed, and then you're the third act of this game is you're going after Atlas, who is Frank Fontaine.
Tenenbaum helps get the trigger words out of your head and like allows you to kind of go off on your own and fight Atlas.
Yeah, there's some fucked up scenes too when you're finding out about the brainwashing. There's like a Chinese or Asian doctor who has all these voiceovers that tells a backstory of the brainwashing, and one of them is like this: while he's discovering how to brainwash people, he's telling this woman to kill a dog, and it's like super graphic. I don't know if anybody got that tape.
I don't remember that one.
Yeah, I don't either. Yeah, hell of a society, Rapture. Sounds like it was. How long did Rapture exist for in the canon of this world?
I think like 15 years.
15 years, yeah. Yeah, well, there you go.
They had a good run.
Who knew a society of completely unchecked capitalism wouldn't end up so well? Who knew?
Yeah, I don't really understand how, like... So I was looking, just like on the side on objectivism for a second, I was looking into objectivism. I've known about Ayn Rand and all this stuff. I've read The Fountainhead before, like a decade ago. I just was like, what is this shit that people always talk about? So I wanted to know more about it. So like the modern day Republican Party in the United States ascribes itself to basically this idea of individual rights. And that's how capitalism is really going to progress. And that's how society is progressing. But at the same time, if you read into objectivism, they like Ayn Rand was like, you have to, there's no God. Like, and in this, in Rapture too, there's no God. It's like no God, no society, only men is one of the things that says on the wall. But like, how do you take way individual rights and having morality in like a modern day sense of modern day political conservatism? They want to be both individuals who are all about themselves and all about pushing whatever they want forward, and then they also want to be churchly people. I don't understand how it is mind-boggling to me that these two things can coexist with each other, with like people like Mitch McConnell and fucking Paul Ryan and who else are the big ones? Fucking Rand Paul, all those fucking dipshits. I don't understand. I don't understand how these two things go together.
Are you saying there's a lot of hypocritical concepts and with modern Republicans? Color me shocked. Yeah, I think we all kind of experienced this to different degrees, that we all kind of went down a YouTube rabbit hole of watching people talk about like Ayn Rand, objectivism, and Bioshock. And I just got to say, a lot of fucking weird people out there making those videos.
there's a lot of like apologists out there who are like trying so hard to make sense out of something that is completely senseless.
Yeah, I'll just
a lot
say
of people out there make.
I'll just say Ayn Rand is probably not fun at parties, and if she was still around today, the only good thing she would be doing is if she had a Twitch channel where she played SimCity all day. That's the only thing of hers I would ever watch if she ever did that.
I bet Ayn Rand would have a YouTube channel that would go some crazy places if she was still around.
It's called PragerU. Just go look. Don't look that up. Nobody look that up. Nobody on this. Okay.
If you want to be pushed into some crazy places on YouTube, go look that up.
But yeah, so eventually the whole game culminates into an encounter with Atlas, who like is legit just Atlas, the statue at the end of the game.
He's like Dr. Manhattan.
I was going to say Dr. Manhattan for sure.
So, again, in the commentary, the people who made this game, the lead writer and Ken Levine, they say that, like, this whole encounter, they're like, it totally does not work whatsoever. And I played this game before hearing about the commentary. I was like, what the fuck is this boss battle at the end, which seems like totally out of place for this game.
Well, I mean, it's kind of a similar mechanic to, like, the Big Daddy fights. Like, he charges at you a lot. You have to use different... He, like, has different elements. So he has the plasmid, so he, like, shoots fire at you, and you gotta freeze him. Or he shoots lightning at you, and you gotta, like, lure him into the water and electrify him.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's necessary to have something like that to culminate. Because after Andrew Ryan, you pretty much beat the shit out of him, he dies. So you kind of need something like the big payoff or the big battle at the end.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like you could have had another encounter like you did with Andrew Ryan, and I think it would have felt similar. Or like, for example, if you like met Frank Fontaine and he was just a normal guy, and then the little sisters came out of the woodwork and just beat the shit out of him and killed him, or like sucked all the atom out of him, I think you would have had just as satisfying. I thought that last encounter was just very out of place to me, but it sounds like you guys have different takes.
I didn't think it was out of place, but I'm not like, I wasn't in love with that final boss fight.
Right.
I didn't get that far.
I never, when I played this game the first time, I stopped before I got to the twist too. So that was all kind of all new information. Like I knew there was a twist, and I feel like it had been spoiled for me at some point down the line, but I had just stopped playing before that. So like I missed this whole second half of the game. This is all brand new information.
So there's two endings to this game. The one, the happy ending where, I thought the happy ending was very satisfying, where basically you take the little sisters to freedom in the submarine, and you live out your days raising them. And they like show you as like an old man on your deathbed with these girls who are older. And you're basically like their dad. And it's like very...
Yeah, they've all lived normal lives now, sort of, kind of.
Yeah, I thought that was great. That was I was like waiting for like the twist and it never came. And I was like, huh, that was satisfying. And then
there's... Yeah, I have to say, this was a good ending, and like, you know, one day we'll talk about it, but Bioshock Infinite like also had a very satisfying ending to me. Like, I feel like they know how to put a bow on it, on these stories in a good way.
And so the bad ending is you're rescued by a U.S. Navy submarine, but you lead an army of splicers to take over the submarine, and then you take over like countries because the submarine has nuclear warheads on it or something. I didn't actually watch it; I just read about it, but it sounds terrible.
It's not great.
Yeah, that kind of sounds like an ending that if you're told you have to have an alternate ending in your game by, you know, your big bosses, that you just make like this like batshit crazy ending that's like just really nonsensical.
Yeah, I feel like this game came out in 2007, like around the time that like KOTOR had come out, Knights of the Old Republic, like Mass Effect had come out. Like these like decision trees and morality trees were kind of becoming more popular. So it seems like they kind of shoehorned that in with Bioshock at the last second.
So a couple little tidbits. So the Circus of Values, welcome to the Circus of Values. That was narrated by Ken Levine, the creative director. And like a bunch of the other vending machines were also done by him as well. Just like thrown in there. All the other ones are professional voice actors, but he threw his own voice in there for a few of them.
Huh. Do you remember that line? Chills down my spine.
But yeah, so I think we're at a good place to talk about where this goes in our rankings, which currently go from number one, Super Mario 64, all the way down to number 81, Jurassic Park Trespasser. Where does this one go? Anybody want to start?
Well, Matt, do you want to start us off here? Like, what are you feeling? Because this was your game. Where do you see this living on the list?
So I'm trying to open the list now. I mean, this is one of my favorite first-person shooters for sure. Like, I know Chikini, Chris, you were talking earlier about how, you know, you weren't a big fan of the mechanics as far as shooting goes, right?
Yeah, I felt I was kind of thought of the controls, the way, you know, aiming and stuff handled. I was like, oh, I was like, this feels like a pretty old first person shooter. And then I was like actually thinking, and there were like so many other first person shooters that had already kind of come before that I thought handled a lot tighter than this did. So that was like a thing that I just for whatever reason the overall controls just didn't really click with me. I hated the way you had to switch guns, like, you know, basically like opening up this like clunky sub menu to kind of cycle through your weapons, like in the middle of like a firefight, with splicers, and then like you would accidentally change to the wrong ammo type if you like were kind of acting too quickly. I was like, this is cumbersome. I'm not a fan of this.
I did feel like some of the weapons, the way they reloaded, how long they took was way too long, and it made it feel clunky. But at the same time, it also felt like it was deliberate in a way like Dark Souls combat feels deliberate, like you're making a choice and they did this intentionally. So like I understand that your perspective, but at the same time I'm like, maybe that's because they wanted to do it that way.
Yeah, and like, yeah, maybe that's, you know, I think some of that was stylistic, right? Like, you know, but like stuff that I'd like is like a pet peeve of mine is like how like every time like you're re-injecting yourself with like a new plasmid or the Eve hypo, like if you get hit during that animation, you stop injecting yourself. And I was like, all right, that's like a frustrating, like artificial difficulty enhancing thing. That like, or like, I kind of thought like the scarcity of the ammo in the beginning of the game was again like an artificial inflation of the difficulty, because I was like, this isn't a game where you're expected to like a Resident Evil game where you're expected to like kind of pick and choose your battles. Like, this is a game that's like you have to fight everybody in the room, or else like they're just gonna like wipe the floor with you. Like, you can't get away from them.
I feel like they did that though because there are other ways to interact with the environment to fight people. So if you don't have that much ammo, it makes you think like, oh, should I go hack this turret,
or sure,
should I, like,
right,
go, you know, get the big daddy to intervene.
Right.
And I also feel like the reason why they don't give you so much ammo throughout, if you're like just critical pathing this game, just going down the main line, is because they want you to go explore like the side areas. Like at the end of the game, like right before you get to Fontaine, there is like this big, like five-story orphanage that is like Frank Fontaine's home for, or not orphanage, home for poor people. And it's like this big, huge building that is entirely optional and filled with like three big daddies before you descend the stairs. I think it's off of the place with the gallows. There's like a big area with the gallows. And then off the side of that, as you're going down to fight Frank Fontaine, you can go into this optional area. But it's 100% optional. And I feel like if you don't explore those areas, you don't get enough ammo. But if you do explore those areas, and especially if you take down big daddies, because like the big daddies, they seem intimidating and they seem like they take a lot of health. But a lot of them give you like over $100, so you can just go to a vending machine and get a ton of ammo.
Yeah,
yeah, money is key in this game. Exploring those side areas are definitely the way to go. As far as that's how I acquired most of my ammo. You know, is going to side areas, getting the money. And then, you know, the second search thing was also key. So, like, if you were searching a corpse and you didn't like what you were getting, you could hit that command and, like, possibly get, like, $10 instead of $5.
Wait, was that a power? I don't remember that power.
Yeah. I forget if it was automatic or something, like, I unlocked. I don't think it was a plasmid. I'm trying to remember exactly what it was.
I don't know,
it's definitely key.
Yeah, there's so many different ways. I feel like you could go back and play this game again and play it completely different, especially knowing what you know about how the upgrade paths and what powers are available to you towards the end of the game. If you play it with a fresh set of eyes at the very start, you could probably play this game in a totally different manner and have just as much fun with it, in my eyes.
Yeah, I feel like if I'm... So, like, I like this game a lot, and I think that it goes high on the list. If I were to be a little critical about it, like, there are certain things, like, I didn't like having to repeatedly, you know, find a lot of different individual items to build something to advance to the next area and then get to another area and rehash that. So sometimes I was like, all right, this is a little samey. You know, when we were talking about the big daddy fights, like, yeah, you could be like strategic and like try to fight them different ways. But if you die, you just automatically, you know, revive in like the local like revive chamber or whatever those things were called.
The Vita tank?
Yeah, the Vita tank. So you could just keep running, and that happened to me sometimes when I was low. I would just run low on ammo. I would just run up, shoot them a bunch of times, die, respawn, run up, and they're still at the same amount of health and nearby. Shoot them again, die, come back, do it again. And I was like, I wish there was a little bit more of a penalty when I died because of this, because it just everything stays the same.
Right.
So that took me out of it a little bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I compare this, like Mike, you mentioned, like Dishonored was what you got you into these immersive sims.
Yeah.
And this is definitely the game that inspired Dishonored and like so many of those other games.
Yeah.
I personally like Dishonored more, And I like this, you know, they came out at different times, and even though this is remastered, yeah, it feels a little dated first-person controls, but actually still pretty good. So for like me, I'm looking at the list. Dishonored is our number 23 list. I personally would put it below Dishonored, but part of me wants to put it above Dishonored because Dishonored doesn't exist without BioShock 2. So that's kind of like where my head's at right now.
I think just in terms of on the story level, I would say that so Dishonored came out in 2012, and this game came out 5 years before that. And the one was at the beginning of a console generation, one was at the end. I would say high marks for Dishonored on certain powers are really cool. Like the blink power is like super cool. But I think just in terms of, I think the level design is better actually in BioShock. And I think that the story is way better in BioShock.
Ooh, I disagree. I think that both of those are better in Dishonored. But that's me.
I would say that Dishonored is very like tropey. Like it's a revenge tale, right? Whereas this is like very different from most stories that you're going to find in video games.
It's true, especially like if you look back to, and that's kind of my like point. Like this was a pretty, you know, trailblazing game at the time. Like to throw a first person shooter out there where you have all these different abilities and it's not like a Call of Duty game, like you're in this very realized underworld, you know, objectivist paradise, like that's, you know, they had a plan going into this game. There's just the completeness of vision that we talked about at
right,
the beginning.
Right, like, right, right.
Yeah, this is a visual Ayn Rand novel. That's basically what this game is, so.
I think Ayn Rand would not like this game whatsoever, so.
Like I said.
If this was an Ayn Rand novel, there would be one protagonist who leads a movement of, wouldn't even lead a movement, would just make a lot of money and own their own company.
Ayn Rand would definitely go for the bad ending in this game.
Yes, I think so.
But yeah, I mean, just to put it out there for you guys, I like this game so much, I thought it was a top 10 game on our list.
Oh, boy, that's...
Wow, interesting.
That's, that's just... I don't even know. I'm like, literally, I lost for words.
It's definitely better than Final Fantasy IV.
Wild. Just wild things being said.
I don't know if I agree that it's a top 10 game.
Yeah.
I think I had way better time with this game than Red Dead Redemption, for example.
I did not.
I think there's so much crammed into the moment-to-moment in this game where Red Dead Redemption had so much space in between anything interesting that I was like, ugh. And then also the combat in Red Dead Redemption versus this game, I was like, you know, auto aim where I'm just hitting two buttons to fire versus being able to interact with the world in so many different ways in the combat was just so much more compelling to me compared to...
It does have a good combat variety. And like, I want to be clear, I think this is a very, very good game. So, I don't know. Maybe this is me being a little put out by Dishonored being all the way down at 23. Yeah.
I think it was a good game. I mean, you know, maybe because I didn't play it when it first came out, it's one of those situations where like I don't have like the nostalgia for it. I mean, I thought it was a good game, but I just ultimately, you know, it's...
And Chris, where do you see this living on the list?
It's well, like I kind of said offline, I said, well, this is better than Dead Space, I'll tell you that. So, but Dead Space, I think, is significantly higher on our list at number 25 than I would have personally put it, but... you know, well, society. We are, so.
Dead Space is in that Dishonored neighborhood. Yeah. 25 to Dishonored's 23.
But, you know, like, Arkham Asylum, I think, is way better than this game.
Explain.
They're kind of different games, right? But it's like, it's, I just think, like, the, you know, like, Arkham Asylum is a world. Like, yeah, you're on an island in this, like, insane asylum, and like, you know, it feels like you feel like you're living like a prison riot. And you know, BioShock, it's like it's broken up into levels. It didn't, even though yes, you can go back to those levels, it didn't feel like it kind of lost some of like that bigness to me, that it was like you're kind of moving from chapter to chapter. And so I just like the aesthetic better of Arkham Asylum, they do BioShock. Yeah, it's just like, I was like, okay, like, this is like that, like I said earlier, it's like that 1930s Metropolis style. It's like, how much have you that's like kind of like a style that I think has kind of been done to death quite a bit in mainstream media, like movies and in video games. But and it's just, you know, I didn't like particularly like the combat too. I had problems. I shouldn't say I didn't like it. I had issues with the combat in BioShock, whereas I think Arkham Asylum, I think like that's a very fun. Like I never got tired of fighting people in Arkham Asylum, and then like in BioShock, I'd be like, okay, well I beat a boss now, or I beat some, or collected some key item. That means like a whole bunch of splicers now are just going to come running at me from this room that I've already cleared initially, and I have to backtrack through. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, the combat was like one of the things I looked forward to doing the least in BioShock, whereas I think like the story and the world building was good, but in Arkham Asylum, I was like, I'm pumped to, like, get into a fight with, like, 20 guys right now in Arkham Asylum. It was just, you know, different type of games, obviously. I mean, it's, like, not a first-person shooter, but I don't know. It was just a more fun game to me.
A couple things on your point. So, Batman Arkham Asylum is set up exactly the same way as BioShock in terms of level design. And that
I was going to say, I see a lot of overlap.
You go down a path, and then you might retraverse like a one little small section of that path, but it's basically the same type of setup. You have it's levels, it's just not explicitly levels like it is in BioShock. And then I'd also say that I got so tired of the combat in Batman Arkham Asylum because it's basically punch, 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 and sometimes like you have to dizzy them, and that's it.
Yeah, I said this on the Arkham Asylum pod, but I think a lot of my fond memories of Arkham combat were based on the later entries in that series and not necessarily the original, even though it's still good. But you're more restricted in what you can do.
I would also say, too, that a big facet of BioShock that we've kind of undersold in this is the environmental storytelling, which is stuff like very small things that you might not even notice, but like if you go into Andrew Ryan's room, he has these two big golden statues that are like looking up to the heavens that are like to show you like that this guy is like a guy who raised himself up. And like when you first land, you see the statue of Atlas and it's like holding the world on his shoulders and it has like Andrew Ryan on the bottom. And there's like all these little details thrown in throughout every single level. Like if you go, we didn't even mention Fort Frolic, which was the stage play with the guy who's like the insane director that you're going around and murdering people and taking photos of people. But like, if you go into like a random bathroom, you see like him, he's like posed a person playing like a piano and like in wax, that's an actual person that you can light on fire and loot. And there's like so much of this like storytelling that you're just dripping throughout this game. Whereas if you're in Batman Arkham Asylum, you're in like a tunnel and there's like a function to the tunnel maybe within the game world, but sometimes there's like the dissonance between the actual gameplay and the story where they just have something to have it, whereas this game like explains everything why it exists in this world.
Yeah, I do think you have to like, so for me it's like I understand, like to my ranking like point before, like I prefer Dishonored as a game, but I recognize that BioShock is the one that kind of blazed the trail there, and this game's consistently rated like one of the best games of all time. Like if you look on like a lot of cumulative lists, like it's in their top 10 or top 15 or top 20, like it's way up there. So you know, I'm open to that on our list as well. Like I don't know if I like it's like I understand all these awesome, great, detailed points of BioShock. It doesn't fully always click for me the same way. Like I would prefer to play Dishonored, so I would put it below Dishonored. And like a personal enjoyability, which game am I going to pick up and play in the moment? But I think there's, you know, I'm on board with putting this a little bit higher up on the list. I don't know about top 10 necessarily, but maybe, you know, in the 11 to 17 range or something like that.
We haven't heard from Matt in a while. Matt, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think, you know, because you did such a great job explaining all like it's a detailed, deep story. Like every thing serves a purpose. Like, you know, it just kind of sucks you in. And if you take the time to look at the details, they really give, you know, a lot to that. So it's, I think top 10 is good. But then I look at like, for me always, whenever I see this list, I look at like 21 to like 27. I'm like, ah, oh, it's like my jam. Like those are the games I play. So like those would always be pushed up higher for me. But I think top 10 would be good for BioShock. I think it is a classic. Where would you put this? I think. I would put this at number 8. I think.
8? Oh boy!
Yeah.
Chris,
you're coming for Chris where he lives.
Oh boy! It's just look, it's a good game. It's just wild to me that this is like. You know, look at this like top 10 list outside of Super Metroid. These are like, you know, insanely important games in the history of gaming. And again, outside of Super Metroid.
Did you just separate? You separated Super Metroid out of insanely important games?
Yeah, have yes. you not played? You played Guacamelee. I mean, that game is basically 100% inspired by Super Metroid, and you love that game.
I do. I don't think Super Metroid is the pinnacle of the Metroidvania genre, nor the creator of it. But you know, I don't think it's as it's good.
You don't think Super Metroid is the creator of the Metroidvania genre?
I think Metroid is the creator of the Metroidvania genre, and I think this game, you know, in the heels of that. But it's just wow. I'm saying BioShock's good, but. To be like in this conversation with like Resident Evil and Shadow of the Colossus and Shovel Knight and stuff like that, just whew, just some hot takes here, it's scorching.
I don't think that's hot.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of consensus that this is a very, very highly rated game.
I'm just saying that highly rated. Whew, it's just a little surprising. That's all.
Well, I'm with you.
This game came out a year before Dead Space, and it feels like such a better game than Dead Space.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Well, we're all in agreement on that one.
So, what's a good medium here for all of us? Because we're kind of stuck in between some of us wanting this as a top 10 game, some of us wanting it in the 20s. What's a happy medium for us?
Somewhere in the teens.
I think, personally, I don't want this to go below Star Fox 64, personally.
Yeah,
all right, so, like, let's take Star Fox 64 then. So, you think it's better than Star Fox 64?
Yes. Is that what you're saying? Yes, 100%.
And you've already said you think it's better than Red Dead. How about Mega Man 2?
If you want to just leave this up to me and play this game, it's a long conversation. So I don't want to play that game. I'm telling you, it could not go. It wouldn't go. Like, personally, to me, if I was... And Chris, again, you mentioned one thing is that you didn't have nostalgia for this game. The first time I played this game was this time. And I think just me playing Dishonored, playing Prey, playing all these like immersive sim games where I see a lot of the details come from them... And also, I think this game is a better game and was made years before, to me at least. That's why I put it so high. And I think that the story is so unique compared to any of these games on this list. I would say, like, you know, games that have unique stories is like, I think Final Fantasy VII is a pretty unique story. But aside from that, like, what else you got here? Shadow of the Colossus is a pretty unique story. Metal Gear Solid is a pretty unique story. But, like, this game has a very, very compelling story, whereas... Like, more compelling than, I think, most of the stories on this list.
Yeah, I agree with that. And you know, I'm a big Red Dead fan, and that was the game that I picked to play for this list. But, I you know, going back on that, like, it's not as tight of a game as BioShock is in terms of design, in terms of level of detail, and just, like, everything moves at a pretty, you know, rapid and controlled pace to go through it. So, you know, if we're looking at knocking on the door of the top 10, I'm okay with it going over Red Dead. And so we're not going below Star Fox 64 at 13.
Yeah, I mean, I like Star Fox a lot better, but I also recognize that BioShock does have a legacy that, you know, Star Fox 64 I don't think necessarily has. You know, I hear that.
So where do we want to put it? Everybody. So Steve, where do you want to put it? Where do you think would be good?
I feel like because you hesitated to get into Mega Man 2, your feelings are that Mega Man 2 is maybe a more important game, even though you were saying you wanted to put it in the top 10. But Steve, that's always a sticking point.
Steve, I want to put it at number 3.
You want to put it at number 3?
Yeah.
Oh my god. Can't.
Above GoldenEye, really?
Yeah. Yep.
Oh man.
100%.
And Resident Evil.
Wow.
And Shovel Knight.
When we talk about completeness of vision, I think the only thing that this game lacks is that the levels are discrete. And to me, that's the only thing. And I think the powers could be a little bit refined, because I think some of the powers are useless.
How about this? I'm going to say, let's put it at top. My vote is 10. Let's put it at 10 above Mega Man 2.
I'm okay with that.
And above Age... or not, wait, so Age of Empires is 10 right now. So yeah, that would bump Age of Empires down.
Chris.
Yeah.
Last call.
Yeah, I mean...
Last argument.
I mean, it's just... I am looking at the game so differently that it's just not even... you know, it looks like it's going to live at 10. You know, I think that's where it's going.
Okay, all right, let's put it at 10 then.
That's exciting.
Cool. Wow, we have a new entrant,
a new top 10 game on our endless list. It is BioShock, and I think that's our. We're going to record a whole bunch more podcasts on the session, but this one has been mammothly long.
This was about an hour, yeah, or a little over an hour.
This was a fountainhead of a podcast.
an atlas shrugged, if you will. Yes. Yes. Cool. Well, thanks, guys, for joining me. We have a new number 10. It's BioShock on our endless list. And you can follow us at It's So Bad Pod on Twitter. Email us itssobadpod@gmail.com for any of your questions, comments, or concerns. If you don't like it at number 10, if you want it to be below Dead Space, it's understandable. You know, this is very subjective and it's very scientific at the same time. So give us your thoughts. Send us an email. itsabadpod@gmail.com. But yes, we will be back next week. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Mike.
And thank you, Matt.
Thank you.